What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
Hello, everyone. You're listening to The Katie Helper Show, and I'm your host, Katie Helper. If you like the show, please leave us a five-star review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And as always, we remind you that this show could not happen without the support of our listeners. To support the show, visit patreon.com/thekatiehelpershow, where for just $1 a month, you can make this show happen. And for $5 a month, you get great bonus content, including extended interviews, bonus episodes, sneak peeks at my upcoming documentary feature film, and more. Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Katie Helper Show. So excited to be here with you tonight. We have a jam-packed show. Really, such a great show. We got two segments, and they're both going to be great. They're both about this disgusting crackdown on free speech, on academic freedom, on activism. And we have two panels. One is from basically Columbia students. And then the second panel will be with Mamadou Tal, who was a PhD student at Cornell, who was trying to sue the Trump administration. But because of the repression that we're seeing and the kind of lawlessness that we're seeing, he decided, unfortunately, but understandably, to leave the United States. So we're going to be talking to him during the second half, as well as his lawyer, Eric Lee. I'm about to bring on our Columbia panel, but before I do that, please do like the stream. Always a great way to support the show for free. Give it a thumbs up. There's my man, Brad Bloom, putting the very easy instructions on the screen. Hit the like button, share, and subscribe. And to subscribe, you press subscribe, and then you hit the bell. Also, please do, if you can, become Patreon supporters at patreon.com/thekatiehelpershow. Again, that's patreon.com/thekatiehelpershow. And if you can afford the $5 a month, that gives you great Patreon-only content, extended interviews, extra interviews. If you can't do that, but you can do $1 a month, and that also is extremely helpful. We literally could not do the show without your Patreon support. And don't worry, no one gets very rich off of this, so you're not funding a jet-setting lifestyle. So let's see. I think that's about it in terms of announcements. And again, thank you so much for your patience. We did have some tech issues, but we are just going to start the show. We're so excited to be doing it. So we're going to bring on to the virtual stage Grant Miner, who is the president of the Student Workers of Columbia UAW 2710 Union and was expelled from Columbia University for participating in the protest movement against the ongoing genocide in Gaza. Welcome, Grant.
Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Thanks. Of course. Mariam Alwan is a Palestinian senior at Columbia University who played a key role in the student movement for divestment during the 2023-2024 academic year. Her activism gained international attention when she was among the 108 students arrested at the April 2024 encampment, sparking pro-Palestinian mobilization at college campuses across the globe. Welcome, Mariam.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Of course. And not to be outdone is another Mariam. This is Mariam Iqbal, who is a student organizer at Columbia, who was suspended through last fall semester for her involvement in the encampments. She's majoring in MESAS, the department at Columbia, which is currently facing the brunt of attacks by the Trump administration. Welcome, Mariam.
Hi, thank you for having us.
Hi. So, by the way, is it MESAS or is it MESAAS? What is that?
So we say MESAS. Which way do you guys say? MESAS. Okay. Middle Eastern, South Asian, and African Studies.
Right. Which, not surprisingly, is under attack.
Yeah.
And we will get into that shortly. So again, we're in the midst of this, not just national crackdown, but global crackdown on free speech, on academic freedom, on protests. And of course, what often gets lost in this is the fact that these protests are about the ongoing genocide. But before we talk about that on kind of a macro level, can you just tell us how each of your stories evolved and what this current status is with your cases now?
Yeah, so I was involved in student organizing at Columbia since October 2023. And since the beginning, I think it was just a shock coming into Columbia because I was a first year student and did not expect to be thrown into this within like the first month of being a student here. So I have no idea what it's like to be a normal college student. There's nothing like to indicate what a normal college experience should be for me. I think from the beginning, we were really shocked by the level of dehumanization that Palestinian students were facing, but also like Muslim and Arab students in general on campus. And one of our core demands was for the university to like acknowledge Palestinian suffering. And now we've gotten to this point where it's just like, that's not even like a fathomable reality. Like that's not possible for them to do. And looking back, I just wonder like how we were so naive. But at that point, you know, the university's role, it seems like it's to protect its students. And this is actually institutional betrayal, what we're witnessing right now. And like under the Biden administration, obviously the genocide was greenlit by his administration. And a lot of the demonization of our movement was done under his administration. I went to jail 2 times in the span of 2 weeks. And that was done under the Biden administration. The repression that we started facing was under his administration. And now this is being carried on by the Trump administration. And we're seeing a level of crackdown that I don't think any of us expected. We're seeing that Columbia is essentially the testing ground for the extent of American fascism. And they're banking on us giving up and breaking our spirit. And that's not going to happen.
Well, I'm sorry that happened to you, but it's also very encouraging and inspiring to hear you say that it's not going to break your spirit.
Miriam summed it up very well. Frankly, it's hard to even process what's happened in the past few weeks alone, let alone the past 1.5 years. But I do think that the root of this is genocide, and it's important to emphasize that over and over because we see a lot of people now saying that this is an attack on free speech. But yes, it is an attack on free speech, but this attack on free speech began all the way back when Columbia suspended the chapters of Students for Justice in Palestine and Jewish Force for Peace and said that they use threatening rhetoric and intimidation because we use the terms apartheid and genocide. And then it just kept escalating from there and snowballing. And this repression has only made the movement grow more because it's made the student body wake up for themselves and see the way that our struggles are interconnected, the way that we can't have our own constitutional rights without stopping our investments in genocide. And it's clear that these institutions, from the national level to the university level, will do whatever it takes to quash dissent to genocide. And that's the root of all this. And I think it's really important to emphasize that. The other phenomenon is that the dehumanization of students has reached a point that I never thought it would ever get. There have been threats of death threats, threats of sexual violence, all of these things that we've kind of become desensitized to over the past 1.5 years. But to see a member of our own community kidnapped and for people to then go and justify it and continue to dox him and bring forth frivolous claims against him while he is trapped in an ICE detention center, while his wife is due to give birth very imminently, it's unbelievable. Especially, I don't know. It's very difficult to wrap my mind around. And I think it's only getting worse and worse. And it's the root of it is because we even been dared to associate ourselves with Palestinians and to say that they are humans, they don't deserve to be wiped out. And the result is instead of humanizing them in the eyes of certain people, we have only dehumanized ourselves by association, which is absurd.
Right. And we're going to talk to you more, Miriam, shortly about the case of Mahmoud Khalil. But I'm going to bring in Grant and then we're going to go back to that extremely important topic.
Sure. My name's Grant Miner. I as you said, I was expelled 13 days ago. I've been in the Student Workers Union at Columbia, UAW 2710, for a while. I've been the president for 1 year and vice president before, and I've been around Columbia since 2020. And yeah, as these two brilliant Mariams said, it's bad. It's bad over here and it's bad across the United States because what we're seeing is a full-fledged attack on, you know, not just the Palestine solidarity movement, but against, you know, civil liberties everywhere. We have, you know, immigrants, you know, just randomly being associated with a gang and then deported to God knows where. We just received word today that, you know, one of those was just a random father. The vice president then tweeted out that this person is now, you know, beyond our powers to recall. So I guess that's just the federal government saying that's that. I mean, it's disgusting. You know, what happened to Mahmoud is happening to student workers all across the nation, to students all across the nation, and just to regular people all across the nation. And, you know, our union got involved last year with the Palestine Solidarity Movement. You know, many of our members would ask, you know, what's the relevance of this to our workplace? And I think it's become, you know, all too clear what the relevance is to our workplace over the past year. I mean, we literally have had, you know, a former member disappeared. A member has fled the country. We have one of our students being hunted by ICE, and our union siblings at, you know, other UAW locals, other student worker locals all across the nation, being deported. And it's just really disgusting.
Yeah. Sorry. Speaking of disgusting, I'm just banning someone from the chat. We are probably going to get a lot of hate watchers right now. So hi, everyone. Hi, Canary Mission. Thanks for watching. Thanks for the clicks. Yeah, you know, one of the most interesting things I think to watch is how people are defending this. And I'll get into this even more during the second half when we have the Eric Leon, who's an attorney representing Mamadou Tal and other people who are being persecuted, basically, by this administration. But it's so funny to watch people who have no idea what immigration law is or constitutional law is making up reasons why it's legal to do what the Trump administration is doing, which, as you pointed out, Mariam, was something that the Biden administration did really initiate. It's been escalated, but it's part of a continuum. But, you know, hearing them trying to make up these excuses, and then you hear the Trump administration say, like, no, it's not a question of breaking any laws. That's not the issue. I mean, someone from the administration actually said that. So it is kind of satisfying to watch people be so thoroughly humiliated by reality to the extent that they can be humiliated. But I want to know if each of you could talk to me about how you became involved in this as an issue, like kind of personally.
I guess I'll go first. I don't remember a time when I didn't know or care about the occupation of Palestine. Like, I'm Kashmiri, and like, that's something that's deeply rooted in my community. Like, as an occupied people, we care deeply about Palestinian liberation. We see it as one struggle of our own because, I mean, India's occupying Kashmir, and India is the biggest weapons buyer of Israeli weapons. And like, I don't see my liberation as separate from Palestinian liberation. I also grew up with a lot of Palestinian friends. Like, there's no point at which I learned about Palestine. I've always known. And I was involved in Palestine organizing even in high school. Obviously, it was nowhere near what Palestine organizing is now. I didn't even know what Palestine organizing could be until I experienced it after October 7th and realized, like, I mean, the state of urgency we were constantly in, it was like, it felt like we had no time to grieve. It was just constantly like, what's the next creative way we can make people realize, oh, genocide is actually happening. And it was like, it was so dehumanizing, and to not even have the ability to grieve. But I think one thing is that the reason that I feel that we have to sacrifice so much for this and put everything into it is because I grew up seeing people not even know what Palestine was. Like, there was no understanding of, let alone genocide or occupation. They had no idea what Palestine was. And I grew up always like trying to push this idea, okay, Palestine is a litmus test for the left. Like, you can't call yourself a leftist and ignore Palestine or support Israel. And I think now that's becoming so clear because all the contradictions are being revealed, and we're seeing like how intertwined Palestine is with like labor, the labor movement, immigration rights, police abolition, prison abolition, all these different issues. It's revealing that you can't ignore Palestine as a leftist, and there's no option anymore. And I think this is a moment of extreme grief for our community, but it's also a moment of vindication where it's like, for so long, we've been telling people to look, and finally they're looking. But it also means that we can't let go of what momentum we have, because we've spent years and years like without any acknowledgement of Palestinian suffering.
And Mariam, where did you grow up?
I was born in New Orleans and raised in Seattle, kind of back and forth. And also I wrote my college application essay on the murder of Palestinian journalist Shirin Abu Akleh. And that was before October 7th, like years before. And I explicitly wrote it on her murder by the Israeli occupation because I wanted the university that accepts me to accept me for who I was. I was told by lots of people not to write this essay. I was told that I would be rejected by lots of people who I could get like a Zionist admissions officer or end up just being rejected on the basis of my support for Palestine. I didn't care. I thought that that essay would serve as a filter for institutions.
A litmus test, yeah, as you said.
Exactly. And yeah. Fun fact, like I wanted to be in New York and I was looking at different colleges in New York. I was going to apply to Fordham and I took it off my list because they had banned their SJP. I told Columbia that I wanted to join SJP in my application. Like they knew who I was when they took
it. Students for Justice in Palestine, just so everyone knows.
Yeah. And I think it's right. Very, very clear that they're fine with theory and all this decolonization theory and posturing about, Palestine, this Palestine, that, until it actually becomes a threat to the status quo and materially challenges their interests. And suddenly it's like, 2 months into my education, SJP was banned at Columbia. So it's just a complete disappointment.
SJP and Jewish Voice for Peace, right? Both of them?
Yeah,
it's nice and fair and balanced of them to do that. Yeah.
I have a pretty boring answer. I moved to New York from California, where I'm from, before I attended Columbia, which was a while back. And I got broadly involved in left politics here. It's a great place to do it. It's really, it becomes easy to see like that most normal people don't stand for what's going on, in Palestine. I've been around the Palestine Solidarity Movement for, a while before the events of last year. So when this, campus movement started really picking up, it felt like a natural time to sort of tie in, things with the union. It wasn't my decision. It was like my members' decision. Like everybody wanted to support our students and our coworkers who were going through a lot. That's how I got involved. You have no choice not to get involved if you consider yourself a leftist. Like it's, as many of them said, like you can't ignore the issue if you're a leftist. There's no sort of, doing any sort of socialist left or whatever you want to call it politics without Palestine.
Right. There's even that term PEP, progressive except on Palestine.
Exactly.
Which means you're not progressive. Like if you're a PEP. Yeah. Yeah. And what about you, Mariam?
For me, it's just like my identity. Like it was never even a question because I am Palestinian. And actually people assume that like my family is a super big activist family, but it's the opposite. My mom would tell me growing up not to tell people that I'm Palestinian, just because if they even heard the word Palestinian, they would jump to these conclusions and start saying, "Are you a terrorist?" Which lo and behold, of course, they're calling me a terrorist now. It was just like, honestly, like the root of it is like my grandfather was, he had an olive plantation in Palestine and he was forced out, during the occupation of the West Bank. And he has never been able to go back since. His own mother died in Palestine and he was never able to visit her again because of the occupation. And people don't understand how apartheid, it tears apart families. It affects every single part of daily life. And so they think, oh, you're just this like political activist. Like, no, it's like, this is a deep personal issue. And I felt that I had this privilege as an American with an American accent who was born and raised in Virginia to go on screen and say, I'm Palestinian. You see me as like, I look like just like you. I sound like you. Why can't you see that? Like I easily could have been them and they easily could have been us. It's like, just because this genocide isn't currently affecting you doesn't mean it's not going to, doesn't mean that you can just turn away and say whatever you want about these people. It's been a crazy journey. Like I was involved in organizing like book clubs and cultural events. And then after all of this started, it felt like almost like a fight or flight response, especially as the repercussions and the repression of even saying anything political came bearing down on us, on our personal lives, and sort of tearing that apart, it just became, like Miriam described it pretty well, like this just like no time for grief. And it just kept getting bigger and bigger. Like I'd never organized or a protest before any of this started. And now my life has completely turned upside down. But despite all of the repercussions, I don't regret a single second of it. Every time I open my phone and I see videos of beheaded babies, of medical workers being lined up and executed, of hospital workers getting kidnapped, and then my own friend getting kidnapped, like there's nothing that they could possibly do to me that would make me regret my advocacy. So,
yeah, well, bringing that up, let's talk about your own friend getting kidnapped. Can you tell us about Mahmoud Khalil, your relationship with him, and how you think the administration handled what happened to him?
Yeah. So I met Mahmoud shortly after all of this began. So it's been around 1.5 years that I've known him. And I still can't get over the shock, frankly, especially because he is like such a diplomatic person who met probably the most with the administration out of any of us. And so they're very familiar with his personality, his kindheartedness, his ideals and beliefs and convictions, and they still can't even say his name. It's just, and then to see the person that I know juxtaposed with all of the vitriol and just blatantly made up lies that are being spread about him, and when he's not even here to be able to counter them, is just so beyond insane. And I think the most important thing that I want to emphasize is not just that like Columbia is silent, or that they allowed him to be kidnapped on their own campus and they don't really seem to care and seem to be colluding with the administration. It's the fact that it was reported in the foreword that members of the board of trustees allegedly handed his name over to the government. And there has been no outcry about this. There's no way for us to call for accountability or an investigation. This entire time, it has been our own administration that has been throwing us under the bus, treating us as subhuman. Meanwhile, they claim that we are the threat to people for simply calling for human rights and an end to their violent investments. It's just like the gaslighting can make you go crazy. Honestly, it's insane.
Yeah. And he reached out. I mean, he has said this, right? That he reached out and asked them. I mean, it's like really heartbreaking to read. He was saying that he was fearing for his safety. He knew that there were ICE agents on campus, and the administration did nothing. At the very least, it did nothing. And for all we know, they actually helped facilitate it. And we know that Betar was targeting him. And Canary Mission, I know, has targeted some of the students who have been rounded up. And it's really, you know, what's so insane is that seeing these idiots like Marco Rubio, he literally said on one of the Sunday morning shows, he was saying, well, he's a negotiator. That's a crime in itself. Like, this is someone who's, as you said, diplomatic enough that the students and the administration were like, okay, you're an appropriate person to be going back and forth. And they're pretending like he's this scary, threatening character. And obviously, if he was that, either that means that Columbia is really stupid and they put a scary, threatening character, chose him to be a negotiator, or what we all know to be the truth, which is that they're lying about him. Rubio's lying and everyone else is lying about him. Yeah. Well, you know, Grant, did you want to say something? I saw you look like you were.
Yeah. I mean, I'll just add that this is sort of Columbia's playbook, is that they aren't helping anybody affected by any of these things. Ranjini, one of our workers who fled the country after they were, you know, had ICE come to their door. The administration was at first, you know, very concerned, or like, don't worry, like your visa status will be fine. I'm sure it's just a mix up. But as soon as they learned that actually ICE was at the door and that it was the administration that wanted them, they just totally went along with it. In fact, they sent a member of staff to go and check up on them at their home, not to be like, hey, are you okay? But to make sure that they knew that they were being evicted. It's crazy. We have no doubt that Columbia is colluding with the DHS and ICE agents, at least in terms of giving information over to these agencies. That's why, like, I mean, all of the Columbia community, not just students. So we had a rally last week with all, like, you know, the UAW staff workers, the UAW postdocs, the student workers all came together to demand that Columbia work to free Mahmoud. Because nobody wants this. Like, who does this serve except for, you know, some trustees that are okay with our administration totally folding to Trump? Like, we need Columbia to have a spine, which, you know, they won't. Right. they're spineless. And so it's up to be, you know, Colombia's spine for them. But, you know, that's an uphill battle.
And also, how insignificant is the funding that the Trump administration is withdrawing from Colombia in the scheme of their endowment?
I believe it's 5%. In terms of immediate grants, like I won't lie. I mean, in terms of like the immediate future for people's jobs, it is meaningful. But Colombia has a $15 billion endowment. That's a rainy day fund. What is this if not a rainy day? Like, we need to use that fund to defend people's jobs. And if your first reaction is not to use the tools available to you to stand up against, you know, what is literally a fascist assault on your students, then, you know, what use is this $15 billion, if not that, if not to save workers' jobs, if not to save members of your community?
Yeah, it's really disgusting. So let's see. Well, I just wanted to make an important point, which is that so you have Mahmoud Khalil, Rumeysa Ozturk, who is the woman at Tufts, who is basically also abducted, detained, and they may be deported. We know Mamadou Tal, who basically fled the country out of fear that he's being deported. There's another Columbia student who is right now being basically hunted down by ICE. But I want to make sure that we keep track of who the real victims are in this story. So let's play a really important video clip of someone
walk with one of my closest friends who's not Jewish, and just out of nowhere, not expecting to say this, what came out of my mouth was, will you hide me? Like, if it comes to that, will you hide me and my family? And like, do I really think that's going to happen in the United States? No. And it was interesting because she didn't really know what I was talking about. She said, what do you mean hide you? And I explained that there are these righteous people that hid Jews. This is the story of Anne Frank. And then, of course, she said, oh, I know what you mean. But any Jew would have known what I meant immediately.
I would have known, like, you were insane for saying that. I like the way she says she doesn't actually think it's going to happen. It's like, I'm going to say something irrational that I don't believe is going to happen, but I would like you to placate me because my neurosis is important. But obviously, I mean, Grant, as a Jewish person, on a scale from, like, Holocaust to Kristallnacht, how scary is it for you to be on the Columbia campus?
Well, I wish somebody would hide her. Like, please, yeah. Somebody get her out of here.
Seriously,
like,
yeah.
Hide her.
Very far, 6 feet under.
I mean, I was just there. I wasn't attacked by any roving bands of anti-Semites. I'm about to be, unless my appeal goes through, which fingers crossed, banned from campus. So I think that's one Jew down, but you know, it's just a distraction from what really matters, which is the genocide in Palestine. It's this whole rollout of this October 8th film is just it's a smear job on the movement. And people should not go see it, but I don't think your audience is really the target audience.
Right. We would hate watch it, but we have to do it in some way like that doesn't give them any clicks or anything. By the way, you know, a great documentary to see that I encourage everyone to see is The Encampments, which I saw last night, and it's great. And you're in it, Grant, obviously, and Mahmoud Khalil is one of the main characters. Mariams, are you guys in it?
There's a clip of me getting arrested, but that's it.
Okay. Yeah. But, you know, like you just said, this is a distraction, and it is absolutely repulsive for Sheryl Sandberg, who has been the face of the Hamas rape hoax, to be silent in the face of actual documented rape. I mean, I say this on the show a lot, but we know that the media, Western media, talked about this mass rape campaign, systematic, systemized rape that was allegedly committed on October 7th. There's been no evidence of that. What there is evidence of is a rape that took place partially on video. I mean, it was obstructed by something, but it was evident enough that this was a gang rape that Israeli media presented it as such. And I'm not talking about Haaretz. I mean, this was mainstream Israeli media that presented as much. People know that there are then right to rape protests. You have rabbis blessing the rapist. You have a rapist becoming a celebrity. Then you have a member of the Knesset saying it's legitimate to insert sticks into someone's rectum. And that's just one case. I mean, that's just one case that we know about it because it was more documented, but there are countless cases. So, you know, I was obviously joking with bringing her up, but it is important because we have to remind people that there's so much propaganda and so much dishonesty. And it's not just like propaganda and dishonesty. It's almost like an inversion of the truth, right? Like, the actual documented rapes that we know about were committed by Israelis of Palestinians. And you'd never know that from watching the news. The same thing with the human shields. I mean, the media constantly talks about Hamas using human shields. And the truth is that the documented use of human shields has been done by Israel. I wanted actually us to watch something. I mean, it's incredibly disturbing, but we're here to obviously talk not just about the attack on academic freedom, free speech, protests, but we're here to talk about what is happening right now that people are protesting about. So I want to show this very, very disturbing clip. It's of 15 emergency and aid workers in Gaza. They were found buried by their wrecked and well-marked vehicles. This is according to the UN. And let's just take a look at this video. And it is very upsetting, obviously, but I think we need to talk about it because guess who's not talking about it? That would be the mainstream media. So let's take a look at this.
The site where the ambulances were hit. These ambulances have been buried in the sand. There's a UN vehicle here. Buried in the sand. Bulldozer. Israeli forced bulldozer has buried them. We're now looking for the bodies of those that were in these medical and humanitarian vehicles.
I'm sorry, let me read what that says. The available information indicates that the first team was killed by Israeli forces on March 23rd and that other emergency and aid crews were struck one after another over several hours as they searched for their missing colleagues.
Health workers should never be a target. And yet we're here today digging up a mass grave of first responders and paramedics. 7 days ago, civil defense and POCS ambulances arrived at the scene. One by one, they were hit, they were struck. Their bodies were gathered and buried in this mass grave. We're digging them out in their uniforms, with their gloves on. They were here to save lives. Instead, they ended up in a mass grave. Their vehicles, their ambulances, UN vehicles, civil defense vehicles are crushed and dumped, covered in sand, next to us. It's an absolute horror. What has happened here? This should never happen. Healthcare workers should never be a target.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I wanted to know your guys' response to that. And also, if you want to respond to anything I'd said earlier about the sexual violence.
Yeah, I wanted to comment on that. One thing is, like, I used to read a lot about Palestine even before college. And there was this book by Nahla Abdo called Captive Revolution. And it talked about the abuse that Palestinian women would face in Israeli prisons. And I believe she wrote the book like 10 years ago. I mean, Palestinian academics, Palestinian feminists have been talking about sexual violence at the hands of Israeli occupation for so long. And it's happened since the Nakba in 1948. It was a tool of the occupation in order to like clear out villages. They would rape women in one village and then women in the next village would clear themselves out knowing that they would be next if they stayed. And like, it's just so frustrating that Palestinians have been saying these things for decades and decades and people are even now not even listening, but even with like actual CCTV footage of an Israeli soldier raping a Palestinian detainee, like I don't understand what it will take for people to finally believe Palestinians. And the other thing is like this inversion that you were talking about. So that's an actual tactic of genocidal rhetoric. It's called accusation in a mirror. And we're seeing it so much with every single aspect of their rhetoric on campuses about campus safety, but specifically with sexual violence. Right. Like I remember so vividly during the first encampment when it was just 60 of us like committed to sitting there until, and then the cops came and everything, I didn't sleep for 38 hours. And part of that was the fear of NYPD coming in just like at any moment. And I didn't want to be asleep when they took me. But it was also that when I was trying to sleep, I remember a white Jewish Zionist male constantly counter-protest at our protests. And he's chanting, rape is not progressive. Like over and over and over, rape is not progressive. And I'm sitting there like, by the way, the majority of our protests are organized by mostly women of color. And there's this white guy chanting, rape is not progressive at us. And I have been reporting like active rape threats and sexual violence threats at me since I was 18 as a first year at Barnard. And they were never taken seriously. They've been from like Columbia students, actual Columbia affiliates, that I've been receiving constant every single day threats of sexual violence, and it's constantly dismissed. And it's like, it just, the gaslighting is so heinous where it's like, I'm seeing actual footage of Palestinians being raped on camera. We're seeing like every single woman in Palestine organizing faces extreme like rape threats all the time. And at the same time, we're getting this white guy chanting like, rape is not progressive at our encampments. I mean, it's just ridiculous.
Yeah, I mean, I've reported the same thing. I see these people harassing our students who are, you know, are young women of color, filming them in the libraries, harassing them on Twitter. And now our university has said that, you know, oh, you can be punished for being anti-Semitic online. You can't be punished for stalking our students online. You can't be punished for publicly, trying to like dox our students. It's disgusting the level of, I just think, sexual harassment that these like young women organizers have to put up with. And, you know, it's not just that they are ignoring it happening. It's that people, including faculty, including, you know, graduate students are complaining on behalf of the students and they're just dismissing it. I just don't hear anything. It might as well be a black box. It's like, I might as well just, you know, write it down on a piece of paper and throw it out my window. It's absurd that like, why is one segment of our community valued more than another? It doesn't make sense to me at all. And like, that's why it's the accusation in a mirror. It's like, I feel like I'm hearing all the time how unsafe, people are on campus when I'm seeing our students and my coworkers being harassed daily and nobody does anything about it. And the second you try to do something about it, then they punish you.
It's infuriating. And you see all these protests. Is this like a Zionist talking point? They're always wishing rape on people.
And then accusing you of supporting rape.
Yeah, exactly. It's the accusation of mirror, right? And then Yeah, exactly. You can just imagine the media coverage that would result from a member of Hamas saying it was legitimate to insert sticks into people's rectums. Like, imagine if you had an imam sanctioning, you know, someone who had been accused of rape. I mean, it would be nonstop, wall-to-wall coverage. But because the victims here are Palestinian or Palestine supporters, then it's not taken seriously. It really is disgusting. And can you talk about the kind of repression that you guys dealt with? Another inversion of truth that we saw the media perpetuating was that the people who were being violent at the encampments were the Palestine supporters. You'd never know from the media coverage that it was actually the police and the Israel supporters. So can you talk about the violence that you guys either observed or experienced?
I mean, I can talk about that. The night of Hinz Hall, like the Hinz Hall raid, was so incredibly violent. I mean, I remember I stopped responding to my mom because I had been arrested pretty early on before everyone else, because I was outside the gates. And she was following the SJP Instagram and she saw a video of a girl being thrown down the stairs by the police. And she just like assumed it was me. I don't know why, you know, moms get anxious. But it was like that night they gave people concussions, like, but they were arresting like people who were trying to help the girl who was thrown down the stairs. They arrested anyone who tried to help her. They barricaded journalists into buildings. They didn't allow any media on campus. That's why there's not a lot of footage of what happened, other than from like students taking blurry videos from their dorm windows. Multiple people got concussions. Like, I myself, like, I was thrown to the ground by like 6 to 7 officers, and I wasn't even resisting. I was just recording them, and apparently that's a crime. But that night was so incredibly violent, and I think collectively traumatizing for the whole student body, because it took place on a central space in campus where all the dorm windows kind of face what's happening. And I think like that was a moment where all the students on campus felt equally unsafe, because the cops were just getting anyone who was there. They were just brutalizing. And I think also, like, this isn't at Columbia, but at UCLA, we saw like Zionists from the outside coming in and beating people bloody. Like, there was blood like pouring off of people's heads, and they threw like what was like fireworks and rockets. I don't even know.
Yeah.
And beat them with sticks. It was like insane how much violence there was at the encampments. I agree, but it wasn't from us. It was from Zionists and the state. And I think also, like, even before the encampments, I think people kind of forgot about this, but like the chemical attack that happened on campus in January that was done by 2 Israeli soldiers. I went to the hospital because of it. And these Israeli soldiers, I don't think they're American citizens. They did commit a crime. And what happened to them? Like, they got $100,000 from the university.
Yeah, right.
they sued for anti-Israeli discrimination or something, and Colombia gave them $400K. And I mean, it's crazy because this is so also tied to occupation, because I remember before this chemical attack even happened, there's an article online from like months before it documenting one of them harassing Armenians in Jerusalem. Like, this guy was just being a war criminal in Palestine and then pulls up to our campus and hospitalizes dozens of us. And then he wins $400K from Colombia. Meanwhile, Mahmoud is being detained for what? Being an unmasked negotiator like they demand of us all the time. And on that note also, we used to mask at the first protest. We were really careful about masking. And the reason for that was we were scared that Zionists would dox us. And like, we were so terrified with the doxing trucks that were going around displaying people's names and faces. We didn't realize that the actual threat was the administration and the state that was going to be surveilling us. Because at one point we stopped wearing our masks. Like me and Mariam, we unmasked at a protest in front of hundreds of people. Because we wanted to be like, we don't care. Like, you can dox us, you can do whatever you want. But we realized the administration uses that to target you. They always call us like terrorists and ask why we're masking, what are we hiding? It's just like, we're being targeted for speaking out against genocide. Like, Mahmoud was never masked since day one. You can look at all the pictures of him in the start. He was never, ever masked. And look what they did to him.
What was really, I don't know what the word, like horrifying. What was really horrifying for me was that, like, it's not even that, like, there has been one traumatic event. It's that, like, it's like a reliving of it all the time. So, like, there was being arrested at the April 18th encampment, which, like, it wasn't very violent. It was just, like, the adrenaline of, like, being watched and the dehumanization of being arrested and sitting in a cell for 8 hours, etc. But then there was the Hinz Hall raid a few weeks later. I was recording on campus, and I was pushed back with all of the journalists and all of the spectators on campus into the dining hall building. And when I came back in August, every time I went to swipe in, every time I went to that location, all I could see was people getting beat up in front of me, because that's like, even seeing people going and getting food at a location that had so much violence in it felt so jarring for me, and I couldn't get it out of my head. And then flash forward a year later, just a few weeks ago, like days before Mahmoud was kidnapped, I was not even part of this protest. Like I had my class on campus and then I had office hours, and then I was leaving my office hours and it was pouring rain. And then I see police beating people up, slamming them to the ground one by one, and the media did not cover it at all. And I just had like a complete panic attack. Like, I fell to the ground because of how overwhelmed I was, because not only from the like overwhelm of what was happening to our own students and what had been legitimized against our own students in front of me, but also the memories of what had already happened. And mind you, I was just a spectator. I was not the one getting beat up. So then I felt guilty for even reacting like this. It's insane. Like, I don't even have words for it, especially because the media doesn't even, it's as if it doesn't exist. So it's like gaslighting.
Yeah. It's repulsive. I also want to show, though, that there are people who are very upset about what Columbia is doing, including Columbia graduates. And we have a clip of them ripping up their diplomas. Let's just take a look at this.
Free Palestine! CFAC and Columbia are working against the incredible efforts their students are making to envision a world where Palestinians can enjoy their full human, civil, and national rights. SIPA alumni are not proud. We are enraged. Woo! And we will continue to rage at this institution until Mahmoud Khalil is free.
In renouncing my degree and tearing up my diploma, I say I will never stop talking about Palestine.
I mean, it's like, people are going to have to put like Trump University, Columbia University, asterisk Trump University, now that they've acquiesced so much. Can you guys actually talk about how the administration has already acquiesced to Trump?
They're sort of pretending that they haven't. And I think the right wing media is sort of also very eager to say, oh, they haven't actually conceded. But let's not kid ourselves. They have totally conceded. They have, you know, expelled, suspended, or degree revoked the students involved in protesting. They have put Mises under academic receivership. Even some members of faculty are trying to tell you it's not actually academic receivership. It is. I mean, it's controlled by a special provost. especially now that the president has stepped down and Claire Shipman is the new president. We don't know what that means. There is, you know, a sort of mask ban on campus. It's unclear. If you have a medical exception, sure, that's the reason why people are saying that it's not a total mask ban. But really, the name of the game is that, like, Columbia can just make up rules as it goes along. So I think that anywhere where it says masks are not allowed vaguely can be pretense to make people, you know, unmask. And, you know, I think to top it all off, there's 36 new special police officers public safety officers or deputies or whatever who are allowed, don't carry a gun, but allowed to use force to remove people from campus or arrest people in order to enforce these new rules, which Columbia is generating these like time and place rules. And this is a huge workplace safety issue. It's a huge issue of safety for students. And if we can just look at the recent past, it's not going to be used well. It's not going to be used equally. It's going to come down hard on people who, you know, a select group of Columbia admins, administrators, and, you know, like, or and donors deemed to be a problem in the university. And that's our Palestinian students, that's Arab students, it's anybody who's protesting. It's not, you know, the people yelling, you know, I wish Hamas would rape you or whatever, who are actually threats. Like, again, what these folks said, it's like, who is unsafe? Who is getting the concussions? Who's getting arrested? Who's getting beaten? Who's getting deported? It's not our Zionist community members. It's everybody else. So, I mean, people just need to sort of wake up and see, you know, who is actually unsafe on campus.
I want to give you guys a chance to respond to a very serious allegation, which is that you guys knew of the October 7th attack beforehand, because after months of dormancy, Columbia SJP, Students for Justice in Palestine, allegedly reactivated its Instagram account 3 minutes before Hamas began its attack on October 7th. So were you guys contacted about this?
Absolutely not.
So they kept it a secret from other Hamas members. Am I correct? Like, other Hamas members, not in Palestine, not in Gaza, didn't know about this, but they made sure to CC Students for Justice in Palestine, Columbia.
I want to make a joke about it.
Yeah.
To even make a joke about it, because they're going to cry.
I'll make the joke. Much like Jeffrey Goldberg, I was accidentally added to your chat. And so I knew. So I'm sorry.
Sigma Gay 2.0.
I did. Yeah. I tried to leave instantly. This is
this is a joke.
I was told this is a comedy podcast. Yeah. Please do not come after me.
Yeah, this is a joke. And if you come after him, it's anti-Semitic. Yeah.
But if you have to come after somebody, come after me. Don't come after them. Come after me.
Yeah, but come after him. Yeah. Or me. Come after us. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, they've said 3 minutes before the attack. They've said 4 hours before the attack. They've said, and it's just like a Photoshopped screenshot. Like, the Instagram's gone. Like, you can't even, it's just.
No, it's flatly ridiculous. This is a transparent attempt to entrap students who were just returning from summer break into the really, really serious charges of material support for terrorism. It's a prodding, like, kind of test to see if this line of legal reasoning works out. It's really important that everybody stands up against it, because, again, if we allow this to happen, like, that's, there goes, you know, your rights to protest. Like, you're done. Right. So I suggest that people, you know, get up and do something.
Yeah. Well, I want to ask one final question of you guys, which is, one of you earlier referred to how this is not just Palestine is an issue that affects many other issues. Obviously, we're seeing how M.A. Cesar talks about how it's like colonialism brought home is fascism. What is the connection with labor? This is to all of you, but especially to you, Grant, as a labor organizer.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really important that all the unions at Columbia are talking to one another about these issues. And I think this especially is an issue for our international workers. 50% of Columbia, or student workers of Columbia's members, are international students. And so really, people are just terrified right now about the implications of this. And, you know, the upside to this is that it brings more people into the movement. If people realize that, you know, the movement for Palestine is intimately tied to our rights at home, then people who might not have had their minds open or who might not feel compelled to act will act. And that can act as a sort of radicalizing factor for these people.
Right. Well, I want to thank you all for coming. And I also want to give you a chance to, if you wanted to, say something to our next guest, because we're bringing on Mamadou Tal, as well as his attorney, one of his attorneys, Eric Lee. And I know that, Mariam, I saw you kind of tweeting solidarity to Mamadou. So if Eric's ready, let's bring Eric on. And if not, I do see Mamadou. So I'm going to bring these guys on, Eric Lee and Mamadou. Welcome to the show. And if any of the Columbia people want to say anything, I just want to give you a chance to do some cross intra-university solidarity building.
Stay strong.
Likewise, likewise. Thank you so much. I really enjoyed listening to the last 30 minutes of this. So solidarity always.
Solidarity forever.
Yeah.
It's their loss.
Yeah, for real.
Seriously. Yeah, seriously, their loss. Yeah. Yeah. Well, any final words from any of my Columbia crew?
If I can, I'd like to plug the National Day of Action on April 5th. Get on the bus, get down there. And after you get on the bus and get down there, talk to the people you're on the bus with, organize, join an organization that's seeking to free Palestine, or, you know, fight back in your area. And, you know, don't just do the one protest, keep going back. But you can start with this one protest.
Okay. And thank you so much. And would love to have you guys back on to talk about, you know, all the new developments, and you guys are doing great work. So keep it up. All right. So Mamadou Tal and Eric Lee, thank you so much for joining. Let's just start off, because I know, Eric, you don't have that much time. And I'm really grateful to both of you, because I know how busy you are. Tell us what happened to you, Mamadou, and why you are now, I believe, I'm not going to disclose where you are, but I can say where you are not, right? Yeah. Which is in the United States. So tell us your story. Why did you leave the United States? And why did you consider suing Trump, and what happened with that?
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on. I'm such a fan of the show. So thank you. It's an honor and privilege. And it's good to see Eric again. It's always a pleasure. Yeah, I think given the high profile nature, I think, to be honest, this story starts with perhaps Trump on the campaign trail, in that he was specifically talking about deporting pro-jihadi, pro-Hamas protesters, right? So I think given the high-profile nature of my case, because I was suspended in September, and, you know, after Cornell relented, I mean, I was on this show before. I think after that point, I felt...
You were actually on Useful Idiots, yeah, just Useful, so people know. You were on the other show.
Yes,
people,
yes.
People don't feel like they were asleep at the wheel. Yeah.
So then, I felt like I was going to be a target. And I felt at that point, it was a matter of when, not if, they were going to come for me. Trump doubled down. He signed executive orders. They're vague. They're broad. And then we sprung into action. And, you know, I still believe it was sound legal advice that we have to preemptively do something, right? And whilst it was seeking an injunction that would offer some reprieve for myself, we were also seeking a national injunction that, come on, like, we did this with just, you know, days after Mahmoud was taken. And look what we've seen afterwards. We've seen people being abducted, kidnapped, Rumaysa. So many others are being bundled into trucks, taken to Louisiana. So, you know, we felt like we had to raise the issue. And I think we're rightfully to do so. What had happened transpired that, and I haven't even said all of the things, I'll say some stuff here. We filed the lawsuit, I believe, on Saturday. Then we hear some word that ICE and the FBI are going to come for me the day after. A day after that, ICE agents are at my house, and they're positioned at several locations at my house as well. 2 days after that, we received a notice that Eric must surrender me into ICE custody. 2 days after that, on the Friday, I received that my visa had been revoked. The official government's narrative, which I can say quite confidently, I think is BS, that, you know, all the federal agencies just happened to get together and coordinate my visa revocation a day before we decided to file. That's their narrative. So in the subsequent kind of, and Eric can give you far more detail legally, but just broadly, you know, we filed a motion for temporary restraining order that was lost. And then at that point, I had to make a decision, right? If I was to win, and I think we were quite confident that we were going to win with at least a habeas or TRO, but I had to make a decision. Does that mean, just because I had no faith in the courts anymore, does that mean I get a favorable ruling and I can now just walk around New York City? I didn't believe that. And I think given given where we were at, I felt the longer I waited, the more I was gambling my freedom. And I think the government was clearly going to escalate more. So I took a decision. It was very abrupt. And I said, you know, let me just dip. And I did. And I made it safely.
And I'm so sorry about this. And it's just infuriating. When you say that they were in different places in your house, ICE, what do you mean?
Yeah. So I lived on campus and I live in like a shared accommodation. So it has several exits and entrances. And I literally had a friend of mine draw where the cars were stationed. And it was like three cars at three different locations. I was surveilling my house. And this is coming after the lawsuit.
Wow. Did they identify themselves as ICE?
So obviously my housemates had been on the, you know, something like this might happen. They went out and they said kind of law enforcement and they flashed the badge without really showing what the badge was and then just skipped and just went away. Which again, I think given the other videos we've seen, that seems to be quite on brand.
Right. So scary. So Eric, what are your thoughts on what we're seeing right now and on this case that you were involved in?
Well, thank you for having me. Good to see you too, Mamadou. Donald Trump's trying to establish a dictatorship in this country right now. What is happening with Mamadou and others is the type of thing that would happen in Pinochet's Chile black bag operations where officials are going around in plain clothes, dragging people off the street because of an op-ed, because in Mamadou's case, the government submitted affidavits saying that it was because he attended one protest, because he was a pro-Palestinian, prominent pro-Palestinian activist. This is just the naked, these are the admissions that the government is making in public court filings. There is no historical precedent for this. There are, of course, many dark periods of American history, especially vis-a-vis suppression of the free speech rights of socialist, communist, anarchist immigrants, the Palmer Raids, the Smith Act, the McCarran Act, 1952.
Sacco and Vanzetti.
Of course. And this is something different, though. I mean, there is both continuity and break because there is no opposition to this from within the political establishment. The Democratic Party is completely capitulated to this. I mean, capitulation is actually not really the right word. It's just open collaboration. And that makes the Vichy government look heroic by comparison. So what Mamadou's had to deal with, it makes me very upset as an attorney. I mean, we are aware of the problems in the American judicial system. We're aware that American democracy, quote unquote, has for some time been, you know, slipping down the slope. But nevertheless, that should not lead us to undermine the significance of the break from the past, which is taking place before our very eyes. And so what we would say is to those who are watching and to those who are listening, I mean, now is the time. There is if you're not standing up right now, if you're not fighting back against this, if you're not exercising your rights, and if you just because you disagree with Mamadou's speech or with the speech of Mahmoud Khalil or whatever, I mean, you know, get serious about politics. This is not the time for illusions in the Democratic Party or figures like Ocasio-Cortez and the so-called left wing, you know, who have supported Biden, paved the way for this, done absolutely nothing to oppose Donald Trump. There is no sugarcoating what's happening right now. I mean, I don't think that the issue has been resolved. I don't think that this administration has massive support. They don't have a million brown shirts like Hitler did in 1933. There's a working class, which is about to get slapped in the face harder than it has been in a very long time. And it's been slapped a lot over the last several presidential administrations, bipartisan. That's the hope. So I think, you know, we'll do what we can in the courts. We did what we could in the courts with Mamadou's lawsuit. Really what's going to depend, what's going to determine whether we live in a dictatorship or a democracy is going to be the actions of people who are watching this.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think it's really important, this point that you made, Eric, that this is both a break and a continuation, because I think sometimes some people overstate how it's totally new. And I think some people sometimes dismiss how it's new. So I actually wanted to show a clip of you on CNN. I couldn't believe they let you on. Maybe is this going to be the first and last time you're on? Let's take a look at at you on CNN.
Eric, to you, you've spoken about the partisan overlap here and a dissatisfaction with specifically the Democratic Party's advocacy for some of these students. What are you expecting? What do you want to see that you're not seeing?
Well, I don't expect anything from the Democratic Party. The Biden administration paved the way for the Trump administration's assault on pro-Palestinian speech. The framework of the war on terror, which has developed over the last quarter century, was an entirely bipartisan, reactionary, anti-democratic project. It doesn't surprise me that the Democratic Party is totally silent when it comes to the defense of the most basic democratic rights of the entire population. Even self-proclaimed left-wing politicians like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez haven't spoken up in defense of Mr. Tal, though he's a resident of the state that she represents in Congress. Our appeal is to the population, that we will do everything that we possibly can to defend democracy in the courts. But the real defense of democracy has to come from the people. And that's the appeal that we make to you. This is not just about the speech that Mr. Tal wishes to engage in. If the U.S. government can go around the streets of this country, pick people up, throw them into the back of vans, drive them to detention centers 1,000 miles away, that's it. That's the end of democracy. This is where the line has to be drawn. The response of the population, not the response of the political establishment, is going to depend whether we have a democracy or whether we have a dictatorship in this country.
Eric Lee, Chris Godshall Bennett, thank you both for the conversation.
So, yeah, obviously, if there's anything you want to add to that, Eric, go ahead. But also, Mamadou, yeah. I want to know your response to this analysis.
No, I think Eric is absolutely right. I think it's the liberal bloodlust. Lust is astounding, actually, in many ways, because, you know, I've seen so many accounts saying things like, well, if you voted for Kamala, this wouldn't have happened. When we have to understand that, in a weird way, it wasn't just the Democratic Party. Biden was to the right of Reagan on the issue of Palestine, right? Biden, it was the deaths of 5,000 Palestinians in Lebanon, and Reagan called it a Holocaust, and Reagan raised an arms embargo. It was Margaret Thatcher who stopped supplying the arms to Israel. So Biden is to the right of Reagan and Thatcher when it comes to Israel. Biden is uniquely Zionist, right? And I think it's important to note that my suspensions and the ideas that Trump is putting into place today was not just made possible, but the groundwork was laid by Biden, and Trump just carried it to another level. So I just reject fundamentally that this is somehow the fault of people who didn't vote for the Democratic Party, who have nothing to offer the working class in the US anyway, right? So I think just to kind of go back to a personal point, I've not been arrested. I've not been accused of any crime. I've not been accused of any violence. I've not been accused of anything like that. And I had to leave abruptly out of the country for my personal safety, because I could not be guaranteed that my beliefs for advocating vociferously for pro-Palestine positions would not result in my abduction on the streets in America. And that's where we're at. And I think, like, I know it's like, you know, I think people are hopefully coming around to understand where we're at, but you can literally have an opinion the government disagrees with, and this could result in you ending up in an unmarked car and transported 20 hours away. I think I really want people to sit with that and think about what that means right now.
So scary. Yeah, it really is. It is scary. And I really hear what you guys are saying, because I feel very, not conflicted, but I feel this so much, that it's both like, would not have been as easy for Trump to do this without Biden, and that there is something unique here. And I regardless, like, seeing people blame people for, you know, when someone points to your case or someone points to what's happening in Palestine and they kind of gloat and say, oh, so glad Genocide Joe isn't president. It's like, don't you have any humanity? Like, even if you think you're right, let's just say for argument's sake that you think there would have been a big difference between those two things. Like, that's not what should be at the forefront of your brain right now. Like, it should not be called like owning, you know, pull, doing an own on people about electoral politics. But, you know, one more thing I want to bring up about how Biden paved the way is I couldn't believe this. So, Eric, you tweeted out today. You wrote, reuse of tattoos to label people gang members. Last term, Biden asked SCOTUS, asked the Supreme Court, to rule it was okay to do so. He won. So can you elaborate on this?
Sure. That was a case that I argued before the Supreme Court last April, and we lost 6-3. We had won at the Ninth Circuit. It was a case involving a U.S. citizen named Sandra Munoz, prominent Los Angeles workers' rights attorney, and her Salvadoran husband, who'd lived in the U.S. for years, no criminal record. The last step to acquiring a green card is you have to go back to your home country for a final interview with the consular, with the U.S. embassy. And they, at that interview, denied him because he has they denied him entry back to the U.S., what they thought was going to be a routine visit, because he has a number of tattoos, including Catholic iconography and a profile of Sigmund Freud, the psychoanalyst. We won at the Ninth Circuit. The circuit ordered the Biden administration. The visa was denied under Obama. Trump continued litigating against us through his first term. Biden continued fighting us during his term. And after we won at the Ninth Circuit, Biden petitioned for the U.S. Supreme Court to take the case and appealed to the most, in their arguments, the most right-wing justices for support, and they won. They got what they wanted. They kept the family separated. But now you see, and I think this relates to Momodou's situation very clearly, total disregard of the most basic due process rights. The presumption of innocence is out the window. You have people being sent to Guantanamo and El Salvador, to Bukele's, you know, torture dungeons for having tattoos that have nothing to do with gang activity. And even if they, I mean, it's just, it's a, but the point is, I think what you're raising, this is the Biden administration wished Trump good luck when he came to office. The Democratic Party has made clear that it's willing to work with Trump on issues of economic nationalism. I mean, just one point I would make in response to the last segment. I mean, the United Auto Workers has played a really vile role in promoting Trump's economic nationalism. And they've done nothing to, I mean, there's, the UAW members are being told by the leadership of that union to keep making munitions that go to Israel. You know, I mean, the UAW has not, you know, taken any steps to oppose the genocide in any meaningful way. They've kept all the munitions flowing. And facilitated the genocide and praised Biden and praised Trump. So I think, you know, that's a point that, you know, we're in a stage of politics where things are so serious that it's important to call people out. Sean Fain is the president of the UAW and has, you know, he stood up and put his hand to his heart at Joe Biden for such a great job he was doing as American weapons made by the UAW bureaucracy were being dropped on the people of Gaza. So I would just respond in that way to that point. But I think the point that we all agree on is there's got to be an opposition from the left. That's and it's got to be international. I mean, those are the main, I think, takeaways from this situation.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I actually wanted to show another clip. Yeah, this is a State Department at a State Department press briefing. Tammy Bruce, State Department spokesperson, basically refused to rule out exiling naturalized U.S. citizens. So here's the video.
On the subject of student deportations, several pro-Israel activist groups are providing U.S. authorities with the names of people involved in last year's pro-Palestinian protests. Among those names are naturalized Americans, people originally from the Middle East, but who are now U.S. citizens. Can you tell me, is the U.S. weighing any action against American citizens who spoke out during last year's protests?
Well, I would have to speculate on that. I also, I'm not going to discuss the nature of the diplomatic or strategic conversations that any department in the government's having, let alone the State Department. What I can tell you is, as just repeating what Secretary Rubio has said, is that if you come into this country, if you've lied to get in this country, and you've come into this country and have committed crimes, or have clearly, if you've done something, whereas if you told us you were going to do it when you were applying for the visa, you would never have gotten that visa. And we're going to be very aggressive in the nature of acting on that. He's made that very clear. But I won't discuss the nature of decision making in that framework or speculate on the nature of what the department will be doing.
Even someone who's become a naturalized U.S. citizen could still be.
Don't draw conclusions because I'm not answering your question.
Okay.
that's a big mistake. I'm not answering the specifics of your question. Don't draw that conclusion. Don't put words in my mouth. That's not what I said. Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
She's like, I'm choosing very intentionally to not answer your question. So please stop pretending that I'm answering your question. I would like to continue to ignore you. But yeah, can you break this down? I mean, what is being said here? And this whole argument that we've heard from Rubio about how this weird argument, I guess it's just they're going with this talking point, like that students like you, I guess, Mama, mm-hmm. do also, this would apply to you, right? Like, because you didn't say when you were trying to get a student visa, hi, I'm going to be doing X, Y, and Z. And by the way, none of the things that like Mahmoud did were illegal. Mm-hmm. So this is just kind of like word games. Can you guys clarify?
I'll let Eric talk to that. But I would say, yeah, I mean, I didn't like apply to get a visa knowing that there would be a genocide taking place. Right.
That's the other thing. Yeah.
But I think fundamentally what they're asking us to do is to retire our moral consciences, basically. And this language is very, this nativist language that they kind of bring in up, that if you're in this country, you are a guest of this country, and effectively you're less than, right? You're less than. Yeah. You come to this country, you should be grateful that you're in this country. And, you know, and that's basically what they're saying to us effectively. And I guess what they essentially say, and given what we've seen with the way Canary Mission, Beitar, all of these things are working, I think, again, people should be deeply concerned that the AI tools are being used. Your social media is now being monitored, right? They are saying that by any means necessary, you cannot have a pro-Palestinian position. And I think people who think it's going to start with, it started with the F1 visas, J1. Then it's going to be, we see green card holders. Until we're going to see naturalized citizens, like the videos, I guarantee. And again, I've been saying this quite some time, though. This is not a position of strength, though, because I don't think you have to repress this a level if you're on the winning side. Ideologically, I think there's a recognition, and we've seen the way, for example, Green Black spoke about the dangers of TikTok, for example, right? We're seeing quite clearly now that Zionism as an ideological project is losing ground. Globally, people are rejecting it. I've even seen like right-wing accounts now when they saw the video of Ramesa saying things,
yes,
I've
exactly.
always been pro-Israel, but this is a step too far. So I think given, you know, the famous understanding of Gramsci, that when power has to show itself, it's when it's at its weakest, right? So same thing here. I think given that Zionism, I think, has lost the ideological battle. We're seeing the state being wielded and instrumentalized to crack down any pro-Palestinian position. But again, people don't realize that the more you crack down, the more people rise up again. It's dialectical. But I'll let Eric speak to the video as well.
No, I mean, I think the only point I would make is sort of a legal political one, which is that the ground of removability under the Immigration Nationality Act, which they're citing in all of these cases, is the foreign policy ground, which says that free speech in the United States threatens American foreign policy. Now, what does that actually mean if you break it down? For 100 years, we've been told that every imperialist war this country has ever launched, no matter how many millions of people are slaughtered, no matter what corporations benefit, we're told it's for democracy. But here we're being told that to make the world safe for democracy, to borrow Woodrow Wilson's phrase from the First World War, we have to suppress democracy at home. So the world, in order to make the world safe for democracy, there can be no democracy in the United States. That's a contradiction which explodes the entire narrative of American imperialist wars abroad for the last, you know, 125 plus years. And it also shows, I think, as Mamadou says, how weak that position is, because it's totally indefensible. There's no legal basis whatsoever for saying that somebody can be deported for attending a protest, writing an op-ed. We made that argument to the district court in the Northern District of New York. The court was not particularly convinced of it, unfortunately, at the peril of the federal court's own ability to keep the executive branch in check. But I think that the bottom line, again, is that we should not expect that there will be any saving grace for the most basic democratic right that Momodou tried to express, which is the right to criticize the U.S. government. The First Amendment says the right of the people shall be protected, not the right of citizens. In fact, and if you say suddenly that the Bill of Rights doesn't apply to 30 million people who live in this country, who work on assembly lines, who go to college, who go to school, that the Bill of Rights don't apply to them, then you've given up the entire game. That's again, we have to, you know, as attorneys often, you know, there's a sense of, well, you can't scare people. You have to make people, you have to calm people down. This is not the time for that. This is the time for, this is whatever one's criticisms are of the faults of the bourgeois democratic system in this country. And there are many points to be made about that. This is a qualitative change. And if they can go around black bag operations, throwing people in jail for attending a demonstration, that's the end of the Bill of Rights. So it's time to step up now, everybody.
Mm-hmm. You also have another client who is at Yale Law School. Can you talk about what just happened to her?
Yeah, so Dr. Helia Dutaghi is an Iranian academic intellectual who was terminated on Friday by Yale Law School on the false grounds that she refused to cooperate when she repeatedly offered to answer questions regarding Yale's allegations that she is a terrorist, which is patently false, came from an AI bot that Haaretz had exposed as promoting misinformation. The academic institutions are playing the most pathetic role that they could possibly be playing. And anybody who's at one of these institutions who has a position of authority, who's deciding to stay silent and not speak up publicly for fear of losing funding or their own job, is a total coward who will be looked back in history in the most shameful way. And there's no excuse for remaining silent under these conditions. That goes for the LPE program at Yale Law School in particular. But I think the broader point is, which has refused to stand up and protect Dr. Dutaghi, despite the fact that they were supposedly founded to study the rise of Trump and the threat to American democracy. Totally pathetic.
Sorry, what is this, the LPE?
It's a program associated with Yale through which Dr. Dutaghi was employed. Okay. She was the deputy director of that program. But I think the broader point is this is an international phenomenon. There's one case which is similar to this, which really has not gotten the attention it deserves. There's a young socialist in Ukraine named Bogdan Sirotyuk, who's been in jail for a year in a Ukrainian jail, which is, you know, this is basically a Nazi government or associated with Nazis, mm-hmm. which has jailed this young man who has health problems for a year in this coming April because he opposed both the Ukrainian government, right. the U.S. government, and the Russian government's involvement in the war, and because he calls for the unity of the Russian and Ukrainian working class against the war. He's rotting in a jail cell. I mean, all of these cases have to really be seen together, and everybody has to be mobilizing. And, you know, there was such a phenomenon in an earlier period of the class war prisoner. You know, the trade unions today have totally abandoned any such references to defense mm-hmm. of class war prisoners like Momodou, Dr. Dutaghi, like Bogdan Sirotyuk. If we can't fight and win these battles, the precedent is set. And I just to return quickly to the previous point, there is no question that they're going after U.S. citizens. I mean, Trump's first orders was stripping birthright citizenship. So who are we kidding? They're going to denaturalize people. I mean, they're going to have a hard time denaturalizing people who have been in this country for 400 years. But they'll try it. And, you know, it doesn't matter how long you've been in this country. If you're a citizen, you're equally American as the next person. So, no, anybody, I think Mamadou put in his statement yesterday, which everybody should read because it's a historic statement, that nobody's silence will protect them. And that's an important point that I think has to really be underscored.
Yeah, I would love for you to actually read that statement, Mamadou.
Yeah, I can read that. Yeah. Thank you so much for giving me the opportunity.
Of course, yeah.
I would first like to thank from the bottom of my heart every single individual and organization that supported me through this, particularly my fantastic legal team. Everything I have tried to do has been in service of affirming the humanity of the Palestinian people, a struggle that will leave a lasting mark on me forever. Today, so this was yesterday, I took the decision to leave the United States, free and with my head held high. For those following this story, I decided to sue the Trump administration with the hope that it would offer some reprieve for myself and other similarly situated persons. But Trump did not want me to have my day in court and sent ICE agents to my home and revoked my visa. We held out, but our first motion was denied. We were due to submit a second briefing with the hope that I could stay out of detention whilst the lawsuit progressed. Given what we have seen across the United States, I have lost faith that a favorable ruling from the courts would guarantee my personal safety and my ability to express my beliefs. I have lost faith that I could walk the streets without being abducted. Weighing up these options, I took the decision to leave on my own terms. This is, of course, not the outcome I had wanted going into this, but we are facing a government that has no respect for the judiciary or for the rule of law. For every person that has remained silent, just know that you are not safe either. Is the imprisonment of those who speak out against the genocide a reflection of your values? Is this the kind of nation you want to live in? We are already seeing the Trump administration exploiting the complicity of those who have remained silent on the Zionist genocide of Palestinians. The repression of Palestinian solidarity is now being used to wage a wholesale attack on any form of expression that challenges oppressive and exploitative relations in the US. It is surreal that we live in a world where you get into trouble for saying killing babies is wrong, where those advocating for and celebrating endless massacres against Palestinians are able to, time and time again, present themselves as victims, while presenting those fighting against genocide as the oppressors. For months on end, we've had to listen to, ad nauseum, concerns regarding the safety of Zionist students when they are the same students who dox, monitor, and collaborate with law enforcement to target students of color. If you have been led to think that your safety is only guaranteed by state kidnap, repression, deportation, the slaughter of children, and the suppression of the global majority, then let Gaza's shards of glass be your mirror. This is a turning point in our shared history. History we remember and we are never going back. Whilst my future remains uncertain, and this now means drastic changes to my personal life, I remain unwavering in my commitment to a liberated Palestine from the river to the sea. As the genocide continues unabated, I ask that you all continue to escalate for Palestine. Continue to stand with the Palestinians in their resistance to genocide and their fight for liberation. Do not seek to secure your personal safety by undermining the Palestinian right of resistance. A world where genocidal violence can be waged with such impunity is a world built on hatred and cowardice. Such a world will only, over time, destroy itself entirely. The only future, the only world we can accept is one we will have a liberated and reconstructed Gaza at its heart. As sad as I feel right now, I do not despair. I have never been more confident and sure that we will win and that Palestine will be free within our lifetime. History will absolve us. The affair belongs to Allah before and after. And you can miss the PS, but I'm good. Thanks for the support. And thank you for the opportunity to read that out. I haven't read that out to anyone yet.
Yeah, that's really moving. Wow.
Thank you.
That's really moving. Yeah, it's beautiful. Do you have any, I have to ask this. I think I know what the answer is, but you said you don't have any regrets, right? So what are you ever like, maybe I shouldn't have done that? Or is it just like, do you ever have moments of doubt, or is it just, there's no question?
No. I think, if I'm being totally honest, and this is not the kind of like, I don't want to, you know, I never want to be a martyr. I think our traditions of radicalism we have too many martyrs. There's too many martyrs in Gaza. We don't need more martyrs. But I would say at a personal level, the only time I thought of myself was the decision to leave. Up until that point, I genuinely was thinking about the movement, thinking about how we can raise the issue. How can we raise the issue of Palestine? And I think for the first time, when thinking about the decision to leave and making that decision, I thought about myself. And it was a thing of like, okay, let me retreat for self-preservation that I can wage a struggle somewhere else, or we can live to fight another day. And that was my kind of calculation. But I have absolute no regrets. If anything, I'm glad what we did. But I do have a sense of like shame that this genocide hasn't stopped. We've been doing, I feel like we've been doing this for 17, 18 months protesting, which I think is still important. And we should never let genocide become background noise. But at a personal level, the fact that we haven't been able to stop this, and the fact that not that there is a cessation of hostilities, but as a resumption to the conflict, I think I struggle with seeing the images coming out of Gaza. And I think I just wish we can go harder, actually.
Right. Yeah. How could you not struggle with them, right? I mean, if you have a heart.
Yeah.
So what is next for you? Thanks again so much for listening to The Katie Halper Show. To hear the rest of that discussion, please join the Patreon at patreon.com/The Katie Halper Show. Again, that's patreon.com/The Katie Halper Show. Please leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And as always, we remind you that this show could not happen without the support of our listeners. To support the show, visit patreon.com/The Katie Halper Show, where for just $1 a month, you help make this show happen. And for $5 a month, you get great bonus content, including extended interviews, bonus episodes, sneak peeks at my upcoming documentary, and early access interviews. Our show is produced by me, Katie Halper, and Brad Bloom. Brad Bloom and Andrew Calloway are the audio engineers, and our researcher is Nate Newborn. Our theme song is by the band Cordova. See you next time.